Have you seen our RoboCop remake? This is a, it's not the actual remake, no. This is actually, it's an anthology. I feel like I need to show it to you now. Yeah, there's a scene in it where it's basically all these different filmmakers, and it was a Vimeo feature film, but it's all these different filmmakers come together and they recreate scenes from RoboCop, but they put their spin onto it. So some of them might be animated, some of them might be, you know, bad suits, but there's one of them, which is the scene where RoboCop shoots the guy, shoots the rapist between the skirt of the woman and shoots him in the dick. Mm-hmm. And this, it does that, except that RoboCop just shoots the dick off of about 300 guys. So every time the scene... every time he shoots somebody, another criminal runs in and is like, "You motherfucker!" And he shoots his dick off, and you see the dicks getting blown to bits until he leaves wreckage of all these bodies on the floor and everyone clutching these pumping blood prosthetic penises. It is unreal. I've got to show it to you. It's one of the most insane things I've ever seen.
Gather round, kids, and Saturday night's big, big movie has been arranged. Brilliant.
I'll use small words that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
What did you say?
You are a sad, strange little man.
Don't call me stupid.
Hello and welcome to The Best Bits, a movie podcast where each week we pick our favourite scenes from randomly selected, weirdly specific themes. This is your co-host Will, a writer of three films and a Christmas special, and I'm joined once again by my co-host and writer of one and a bit films, a lovely, lovely Valentine's Day card to my cat, and three and a bit episodes of TV, Kevin. Kevin, hello.
Hello, Will. How are you?
I'm good.
Did the cat like the Valentine's card?
I want to say, my cat has been...
Are we
going to
start doing that from now on? Just start adding in sort of made up things?
What do you mean made up? He loves that card.
She told me she couldn't read.
Igloo.
Oh, God.
Kevin, how are you?
Well,
it's good to be here with you again.
It is. It's good. And, you know, seeing as this week's episode is all about scenes of inappropriateness, I decided for this podcast to strip off Will, and I am naked from the waist down and gently rocking back and forth on a wooden rocking chair. And I feel in the zone and I'm ready to record.
Oh, Lord. Is there a bottom on this chair? Is there a bottom underneath this chair, Kevin? I just need to know.
There is, and it's quite smooth and quite comfortable.
Oh, God. Oh, please.
I thought that would be nice and inappropriate.
That's so inappropriate. It's so inappropriate. Now, Kevin, can you, because you are exceedingly good at pitches, and you're exceedingly good at pitching this particular podcast in our format, there's people going to be joining us for the first time, and give them an idea of what they're in for.
You know, when you say that, that just makes me, that all my instincts say, pitch this as badly as you can, make it the worst possible pitch. But I'll try and do it in a concise way. We have a decision wheel, a big decision wheel that's got 300 different scene suggestions on it. Each week, we take turns in spinning the wheel, and it's filled with types of categories like action scene, chase scene, zombie scene. And so far, we've done tearjerkers, musical numbers, sex scenes, Harrison Ford scenes. And this week, it's best I can't believe that was in a kids' film scene.
Yeah. So, Kevin, hey, let's dive into it.
Hang on, let me just put on some underpants.
Oh, I'm actually kind of glad of that. Kevin, we're back. And here I am. I got this inappropriate kids' scene in a kids' film topic. And it was one of those strange, unusual topics that I'm sure was put into the wheel with great thought and consideration. But let's just say it did open. What was interesting about it did open a kind of a can of worms into my own childhood personal nightmares. And I'd like to thank you for that, Kevin.
Because you're welcome.
Too soon. But first, I want to ask you, did you have any kind of an initial, where did your gut go to when you first thought about it, this particular topic? Do you have any kind of picks?
Yeah, well, I had about four or five different picks, and like they kept changing. But because the 80s was so sort of out there, I first was thinking that I was going to pick Big. Because, you know, Big is the story of a 13-year-old boy trapped in the body of Tom Hanks who gets his hole off of a businesswoman. And I thought that is such a weird, strange film and such a strange concept that that would be my pick. But I didn't go with that one. Right. And then I thought I might go with Back to the Future. Which is, you know, obviously everyone knows the story to that, but it's the story of a boy racer who travels back in time in a robbed car and has to stop his horny mum from trying to shag him out of existence. And I didn't go with that one.
Well, you know what also is so inappropriate about that, Kevin? Is that
what?
We have this relationship he has with a... this new, whatever, 40-year-old or 80-year-old nuclear scientist. This just random relationship. This single man who's befriended a teenage boy, and there's nothing really kind of said about it. It's just like, yeah, they're buddies. You know, where did that whole thing
come
from?
The other one is Billy in Gremlins. His best friend is a 12-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
And no one sort of questions that either. It's like the kid that is in the Christmas tree farm, Corey Feldman, is his best mate. And it's sort of like when you're a kid, you watch it and you think, oh, yeah, they're just mates. Why wouldn't they be mates? Billy's cool. Then when you get older, you think, doesn't Billy have any mates of his own age?
But it was the 80s.
There's a lot of weird things in that film. I saw that film on the big screen in L.A. a few years back. And... but it was introduced by the cast. And you're watching it, you're thinking the tonal shifts of that film are like wildly all over the place. But you also sort of like, you know, as a screenwriter, I was watching it and I was questioning, hang on, Kate works at the bank with Billy, but she also works at the bar. It's like, why does she have two jobs? And maybe it's to support her family when her dad is dead. But there's a lot of sort of all over the place inconsistencies of that film, but I still love it.
If it was contemporary America, you'd be asking, why doesn't she have four jobs? Because that's just what's normal for a middle. Why is she only working two jobs?
Yeah. No, but when I was sort of thinking about it, I think I have a higher threshold for what's considered freaky or fucked up in a film, because I saw adult films, not the dirty adult films, but adult films when I was a kid. When my parents were getting divorced, I was staying at my older cousin's, and they showed me over the course of one weekend, when I was 5 and a half, and this is not an exaggeration, I thought I was 6, but I was actually 5 and a half because they'd moved out of that house before I was 6. But I saw over that one weekend, and these were the first full feature-length films that I'd ever seen, because I would have been watching like kids' TV shows and Flintstones and stuff like that. But I saw Halloween, Halloween 2, The Terminator, American Werewolf in London, all in one weekend.
Oh my god.
So kids' films after that, it was like anything goes.
What genre did you start end up writing in? Horror.
I definitely got warped, definitely. But no, the only kids' film that I ever saw that really did get under my skin and freak me out it's a 1978 British animated film about a bunch of warring rabbits who repeatedly rip the shit out of each other for mating rights. And it's Watership Down.
It's a beautiful day. All is calm and peaceful in the meadow. Or is it?
Oh, man. And you know what? I've seen the clips, but I've never seen the film.
It's such a dour, horrific, creepy, disturbing film. Like, it's so violent, and there's just so much death in it. There's like a sequence where all the rabbits are being buried alive in the warren, and they're all hallucinating and suffocating, and they're piled up to each other, and all the rabbits, for some reason... of the heroes, Warren, have red eyes, so they look really crazed and creepy. Wow. And it's also got that horribly, horribly depressing theme song, Bright Eyes. Bright eyes, burning like fire. But Yeah, that's the only kids' film that ever really, I just felt it was unpleasant. Everything else was like, yeah, that's kind of creepy, that's, but it's also kind of cool. And yeah. I think you roll with the punches more as a kid. So that stuff just washed off me. But that film really just disturbed me because the rabbits were just mangling each other.
Yeah, I've seen the clips, Kevin, and Jesus, you question what audience is this for? Because there's blood, there's blood dripping off their poor little nibbly teeth, and oh God, it's horrific looking. What age were you when you saw this?
Oh, when I saw that, I must have been. It was on the BBC. I saw it in England, okay. So I must have been around the same time that I saw Halloween and stuff, when I was in my, between 5 and 6, because I left the UK when I was, before I turned 6, so it was on the BBC, it was made in 78, but it was repeated a lot on British television in the 80s, because it was a huge hit, but it's a film that people outside of the UK have not really seen, it didn't travel as well. But it's a creepy, creepy film.
It wasn't really in the pop culture even here across the water. Like, you know, I know the film, that the book is kind of a treasured classic in the UK, but not so much here.
And do you know what it is as well? It's rated U, which means that it's perfectly acceptable for all audiences, and it's
lordy,
not.
Lordy,
I promise
lordy,
you.
Lordy.
There's a seagull in it which tells one of the rabbits to piss off.
We help you. Piss off!
Oh my, but and I want to where I want to kind of go is I went back.
I suppose
and I
you
thinking,
have to talk about ratings when you're talking about inappropriateness.
Yeah, you certainly do, and this is going to be ratings is going to come up in this conversation and the evolution of one particular rating, of course, and we're going to have a reoccurring character from the previous podcast
is his
episode
name Jack?
As well, which is good. His name is Jack, and what's his surname? Kevin Lehan. What is it?
Valenti.
There we go. That's our man. He makes another appearance in this episode. Because like you were talking about there, and I'm talking about, we can't set aside the fact that we both grew up in the 80s. So we have that kind of subjective experience where the formative films for us were kind of overlapped, and they were from the US, from the 80s blockbuster pipe. And we couldn't help it. But so I said,
got it from both sides, didn't we? We got it being in Ireland, you get a lot of British culture and you get a lot of American culture. Yes. And we sort of passed that between our own sense of humor and things. But it's a lot of Amblin stuff. And Amblin is, of course, you know, it's a lot of dark subject matter in those films done with a very light touch.
Yeah, exactly. And so I want to get into inappropriate scenes in kids' films, right? And I want to do it from the autobiographical, you know, from that point of view. And I want to take you, Kevin, back to Kentork. You've never been there, probably. Nor West Cork.
I have, but I'm usually passing through it as fast as I can.
There you go. And the Cozy Cinema, which is our little one. It was a one-screen cinema back then. It was our little local cinema run by neighbours of mine. The Reardons. And
do you know how you might have a memory of something and then you go back and you see it and it's totally changed? I bet if you went back to the Cozy, you'd actually find out that there was somebody's shed.
Well, the Cozy only closed down in the last 5 or 7 years. Like, you know, I was in there. I saw the Muppets movie, the most recent one. Well, the Muppets movie about 10 years ago there. So, yeah, I did. Like, it felt so much smaller when I went back there, you know, as an adult. But when I was about four, I discovered that there was a cinema in town and it wasn't just like a traveling circus. And my mind was blown. I just couldn't fathom that there was a cinema in our little town all these years, and I never knew about it. And I remember my father just kind of laughing at me, kind of going, yeah, there is one, like, and it's here the whole time, like, you know. And I was going, well, can I go to it? Am I allowed to go to it? And he says, yeah. And it just so happened there was, they had a re-release.
Do they have electricity?
They have a, wow, this is unbelievable. Oh, the seats too, brilliant. And doors, and oh my God. And they were showing a revival of The Jungle Book. And I went in and made me all buy. I don't really remember much about the film, but I remember going, this is great. And so I think I pestered my old lad to take me to every I think I probably pestered him loads, because I can remember going to the cinema like late and weeknights going
at 8 o'clock
screenings. And I must have been five, I'd say. I must have been five. And he took me, and I remember going seeing Return to Oz. Like, oh my God, talk about yeah. That's trauma there. That's a dark one. I think what happened was, we ended up going to, he would go and he would fall asleep. And I think he kind of got to the point where, I think it was the Care Bears movie around 1985. Where he just went, I'm out. I'm not doing this anymore. And there was...
I'm not watching these fucking bears.
Yeah, it's like, fucking Christ above. And it came to the point, I remember another film was coming out. I got in word. There was another movie coming out. And the old man said to me, he says, we'll go on Saturday. And sure, you're old enough to go now yourself, aren't you? And I went, yeah, Dad, of course I'm old enough to go myself. And he says, grand. And he went up, and I remember him walking me to the box office. It's a small little like closet, and he paid for my ticket, and he asked, "Oh, when's the film over?"
How old were you?
Well, I'd say I was maximum I was six, right?
Dude, and this film is the thing, right? Just pause just a second.
Okay.
Could you imagine anyone today allowing six-year-olds to go to the cinema by themselves? I don't care if it's a small town.
I've got a six-year-old. It's like, no. Yeah. Like, literally, I was on my own. Like, no supervisor. Yeah. I wasn't going to meet anyone, right? And the film was Pinocchio, okay? And I walk in. We're late, first of all. So when I walk in, and it's a Saturday matinee screen, and we walk in, and I walk in on my own into this dark room, and the place is packed. Absolutely jam-packed, right? And so you imagine walking to a dark room, but you just know there's all these faces, and it's dark, and there's this loud and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, I know I've been there a couple of times, but this is a different situation. And by the way, when I left, when my old man was leaving me go, he kind of slipped an old 50 pence piece into my hand to say, go and get yourself something in the shop. Like, and I remember going, 50 pence piece, oh my God, that was brilliant. So I sat there. And I went in, I was clutching, I had no pockets or something. I was something about me not having pockets. We couldn't afford pockets. That's what happened.
Did you have pants on at least?
I at least, maybe, possibly had pants. No, definitely no shoes. But I walked in anyway, and I think there was a seat way up the back. And I sat down between these strangers. And I remember there was one boy beside me. And as soon as I sat down, the boy beside me, he just went, how old are you? And I was like, and I think I aged myself up or something. And
12.
And he says, I was like, I'm 14. No, I said, like, maybe it was like 5 and a half. And I said, I'm 6. And he went, yeah, I'm 8. And I sat there, and he just
thought it was an old man or somebody. Was saying,
yeah, no. Yeah, but to me, he was an old man. An 8-year-old to a 5 and a half-year-old is an old man. And so Pinocchio was going on. And it's all lovely and like nice, and it. But this fella beside me, he doesn't stop interrogating me for the whole first half of the film. And he goes, "What school do you go to?" And I was like, "Going, I'm the one up the road." Do you have any brothers?
The typical cinema experience.
Brothers, he says. And then it came to the question that really put me on edge. Do you have any money? I was going, and I could feel my fist clenching around the 50. I can still, my left hand, Kevin, it was in my left palm, and I clenched it, and he says, do you have any money? I went, no money, and he went, all right. He just kept questioning me, kept dragging info out of me, and I kept lying, I says, I'm 6'10", I know how to use
guns. Did your nose keep getting bigger as you were lying?
Yeah. And meanwhile on the in the movie, I'm watching the film of little Pinocchio kind of going out into the world, being kind of harassed and kind of coerced by a sly fox and his little sidekick. Yeah, and I was going, I'm him, this is happening to me in real life. And this fella, and then I see him being taken away off to this island, and he meets other bold boys, and they start drinking and smoking cigars, and something happens, they all start turning into donkeys, and I'm there holding on for dear life. And then the film goes into intermission, and there's a stampede of kids out the door. Remember, this is intermissions time, when you could have an intermission, and they stampeded out to the shop with all their 10p's and their 20p's and getting their Robin Hood-like lollies and their Tato's, you know, cheese and onion
crisps. Sounds like the Wild West.
It was the Wild West. It was the Wild Northwest Cork, Kevin. Of course it was. And I sat there with my 50p piece clutched in my fist, and I couldn't go out and spend my 50p piece.
Oh, because you lied.
I told the boy, I told him, I said I'd no money. And if I came back with Robin Hood Bar. Yeah, and I can't lie, because I would be caught in my lie. So I just sat there, and he came back with his big feast of stolen popcorn and stuff like that. And it was literally that experience of watching Pinocchio and that cinema experience with this strange, really intrusive boy beside me was an awful, awful traumatic experience. And I didn't go back to the cinema for a few years after that. That's no word of
Jesus.
A lie. I just wouldn't go back. Yeah, I was really shaken by it, like, you know.
But I'm listening to you telling this story about Pinocchio, and I'm thinking, what was the first film that I saw in the cinema with my dad? And It was Jaws: The Revenge. So you can see how both of our careers went in different directions based on the films that we saw. I wasn't going to see Care Bears. I was off to see, and I was reading to the shark.
Jaws: The Revenge actually wasn't scary. That's the only positive thing about. No, it wasn't scary.
But it was actually
very
funny.
I would say. Yeah. I think I remember kind of, like, I watched it on video, and I remember kind of going, "Oh, that's pretty good. It wasn't scary. I was kind of happy that it wasn't. If I got a horror film that wasn't scary, I thought it was good. You know, that was the way I measured horror movies when I was a kid.
That was boring. That was brilliant.
Yeah. my first kind of, like, in, I felt that scene with those kids when they were kind of like, and I think it's still the case now when I watch that film, when I watch Pinocchio, when those kids are taken off the island and they're turned into donkeys, like, they're kidnapped. It's horrific. It's terrifying. And yeah, the scene of them transforming to donkeys is really, really disturbing.
Help you. Oh, be a pal. Call that beetle. Call anybody.
They're drinking, they're smoking, you know, it's really, really disturbing stuff. And chronologically for me, that's kind of like one of my first, the first inappropriate
shitty experience in the cinema.
Shitty experience, but a film that kind of like traumatized me as well, you know, inappropriate scene sort of thing. You had the Capitol Cinema.
I was in the big bad city, so you were away in the sticks in a very parochial little part of Cork. And I was in the big bad city. And I was off to the cinema quite frequently by myself by the time I was seven. And saw everything that was coming out that appealed to me, that I could get into as well. It was a multi-screen cinema, so I was living large. I had loads of choice.
Man, you're leading me up to another awful experience and inappropriate film, I feel. That I had, and I went to see this opening weekend, summer of 1989. I went to see Batman in the Capitol Cinema with my cousins.
Yeah. I saw that as well. Did you see that in the Capitol?
Yep, because I was up.
We could have been in the same screen.
Quite possibly, yeah. Yeah, it was a midday screening, matinee screening.
And I'm having a memory now of a guy that was sitting behind me and was whispering in my ear, "Do you have any money?" It was you, Will, wasn't it?
Well, I just learned from experience, and I thought that
the
was
bullied
the
people become
when
the
go
bullies.
To you just take from the weaker, smaller boys. I'm still doing it today.
At that stage, I still would have had an English accent, so I was getting it from all ends.
Oh God. But yeah, I feel that Batman was, you know, overall, I would say it's kind of like a typical Tim Burton thing. All these films are inappropriate for kids. They're really, I remember Batman was the first film I actively wanted to walk out on. I really,
really?
And truly, yeah, I went, this is too dark, this is too oppressive. This is not what a superhero movie should be. Because I was kind of the...
You were a little uppity, like, 9-year-old.
Yeah, this is not my Batman.
Yeah. My Batman wears Lycra tights, and he's got Robin, and this is an outrage.
But Kevin, It was my, like, he, Adam West was my Batman. He was.
I loved that show. I was so into that Batman 89. I was collecting all the cards as well. I loved it. I remember I wanted to buy the soundtrack, and my cousin had the Prince album on vinyl, and I used to go around to his house to listen to it. I was all in on that Batman film. I loved it.
Yeah, so that one was for me. I just find the entire tone of that film, the graphicness, the meanness. There's a kind of a mean tone to that film, with very little lightness for a family film.
You know what's weird though about that one is that I got in to see Batman by myself, unaccompanied with a mate, and I couldn't get in to see Batman Returns. I was too young. So in the space of the first and second film, he'd obviously, you know, gone way further with the inappropriateness, but I was really pissed off. I remember standing outside and thinking, but I saw the first one, why can't I see the second? No, you're too young.
Wow. Wow. Like, I had a jolly at Batman Returns. Like, I kind of felt, I'm too old for this, almost, for Batman Returns. But I really enjoyed it. I thought I was totally in the zone for it at that stage.
Yeah. I saw it on video, unfortunately.
There's another glut of 80s movies that came out that really, really effed me up. You've already mentioned one, and it's Gremlins, right?
Mm-hmm. Is that a kids' film? I asked that on Twitter today, and I'm not sure.
And what did people say?
It was split right down the middle. There was people saying yes. It was about 60% yes and 40% no. Yeah. So I don't know. I always assumed it was a kids' film, but when I was in LA that time when I was interning, there was a guy who'd not seen it, one of the other interns, an American dude, Wheeler. And I said, you got to see it. It's such a great film. And he watched it, and he thought it was the most fucked up film ever. He thought, this was a kid's film? This is what you guys were watching? Yeah. This is fucked up. I was like, no, it's not.
Well, that's what we were watching. It was what we were watching, because I can, my only, before watching the film, my only exposure to Gremlins was walking through the video library and seeing the cover, the video cover on the shelf.
They're here.
But there was a box, but coming out of the box was this nice kind of brown and white furry arm and with a little hand. And it's kind of cute. And you go, oh, they're here. This could be kind of cute.
It's like the Care Bear movie, live action.
Yeah, a little bit, you know. But the scene specifically in that, you know, that is the most disturbing, aside from all the other stuff.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say.
It's the Santa Claus story.
Now I have another reason to hate Christmas.
Okay, what are you talking about?
The worst thing that ever happened to me was on Christmas. God, it was so horrible. It was Christmas Eve. I was 9 years old. Me and Mom were decorating the tree, waiting for Dad to come home from work.
Do you know that they fought so hard to keep that in as well?
Really? Wow.
They did.
Like, it's
Spielberg
ballsy.
Wanted it out. He thought it was way, way too dark. And Joe Dante was like, this is the whole spirit of the movie. This is what it's all about. It's a cynical Christmas film. And and personally, I think it makes the film, but it is so, it's so random when you watch the whole film in especially on the big screen where, you know, you can't look away and there's no ad breaks or you're not being distracted by, you know, making a cup of tea. It's tonally, it's all over the place, that film. But that scene, I love it particularly, but I get why people would think it's so fucked up.
But imagine, I don't know how I blanked it out, because I never copped. I watched that film. I watched Gremlins several times. It was like the scary bits weren't really that scary to me as a kid. There was a couple of bits when they were like in their eggs.
Do you
and
see what I see?
Transforming. Exactly. That, and I found that was a bit, oh, I kind of want to look away. But then when they're the kind of the menacing gremlins, they're kind of goofy and they're cartoon, you know, Looney Tunes-esque, like, you know.
You know why that is? Because dialogue doesn't seep into our heads as much as visual information. I was taught that years back, where if you need to tell the audience something, show it to them, don't tell it to them. So you probably it just washed over you because it's a monologue.
Yeah, it did. As a kid, it totally, I just blanked it out. I just didn't. I just went, no, I don't know what they're talking about. It's whatever. And that totally, you know, didn't affect me at all, really. And the another film, now, you see, what happened was in this era,
it's so
in the
sad,
early 80s.
Scene.
It's awful. It's devastating.
Oh, she sums up Christmas by saying,
that's funny, you know, because I always thought everyone was happy during the holidays. no matter what.
Well, most people are, but some aren't. Well, everybody else is opening up their presents. They're opening up their wrists.
It's like, Jesus Christ.
Oh, Jesus Christ. That's right. I didn't understand that either as a kid. But Jesus, but as an adult, when you come back, when you watch some of these films, you just go, oh my God, this is... I would never show that to my kids. I would love to show them Gizmo, but I could not show them that.
I think that would properly, you know, remember I was the guy that was watching teenagers getting strangled in cars and stuff. So I was like all in for it. It was cool to me.
Oh God.
But I think it might be too traumatizing because kids have gotten a little softer nowadays and
They've been fed on a diet of, because we were the only generation that was the 80s generation, Kevin. It's not as if
Why
it was
is
all
that?
Like.
I wonder whether it's sort of like we were seeing entertainment that was being made by people that had lived through, you know, the 60s where all their heroes were being assassinated in the States, you know, Martin Luther King and JFK and RFK and, you know, you had Vietnam and stuff. And I think when those adults got into positions of power and telling stories for children, they really wanted to make films that their peers would think was cool. So that they were quite harder edged. There's a lot of shit being processed, I think, through those films. So that's my only explanation for it, and that's purely like, you know, without any research done into that. But I just wonder whether the era that those filmmakers grew up in was such a cynical period that I think it played into the films.
I think you're right. I think that is definitely one aspect of it, and I do think another. Like aspect to that perfect storm is Steven Spielberg's rise to power and prominence, because a common denominator amongst all of these films we mentioned Gremlins and another film that came out that summer, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, which was one that had seriously disturbing scenes in that of.
Yeah, hearts being ripped out of chests.
Hearts being ripped
kids
out.
Kids being whipped.
Child slavery. And even, I think, the most disturbing, you know, I would look away when the heart was being ripped out.
I would lean forward.
Yeah. You would say, I wonder what that would taste like if it was salted and put some barbecue seasoning on it. But you know, the thing about that movie that kind of disturbed me the most was when Indiana Jones is brainwashed to become an acolyte. That's the one thing where I go, hang on a second. Indiana Jones is Indiana Jones, and you've just taken away Indiana
evil.
Jones. He can't be evil. They made Indiana Jones evil. And that's kind of like the Superman 3 idea. And that disturbed me as well, as when Superman, when your good guys become bad guys. That was really fundamentally different.
When he became an alcoholic?
When he became an alcoholic, when he split. And
you just mentioned Superman 3, you were gonna mention Vera, the henchwoman, who gets turned into a Terminator by the supercomputer.
Yeah.
I also thought that was really cool, but there's loads of people. Anytime you ask people what sort of moments disturbed them in films, kids' films, that one always pops up. People were traumatized by that. I thought it was amazing.
I wanted to look away. There's a graphicness, there's a real horror on her face, and there's a real sense of torture. There's a real sense that of, yeah, I can't tolerate it. It really disturbs me and it makes me want to.
Yeah, you don't want to be complicit.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Yeah. So this is an interesting thing, right? You were talking about like why did this happen? Now what happened was when Gremlins and specifically Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom came out, they were all released with a PG rating.
Violent scenes in two of the most popular summer movies, Gremlins and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, provoked the new rating. Complaints from parents that some scenes were simply too intense for children persuaded the motion picture industry to come up with PG-13, a warning to be attached to some new films released after July 1st.
And Spielberg, yes, he's a great filmmaker, but there's another thing about Spielberg is that he is a shrewd businessman. And he was aware of the potential damage that this backlash to his kind of darker tone of films that he was directing and producing, because not only was, I think, more so the stuff that he was coming out with, the stable of Amblin films that he was producing at that stage had that. We have Poltergeist and Gremlins and Temple of Doom. And he saw that, hang on a second, this kind of these darker edged films are going to be financially hit by this.
See, whenever people talk about Amblin films today, whenever they sort of reference it, that this project is quite Amblin-esque, they always use that in relation to the film having heart. But for me, the Amblin films were just, they were horror films. They were films that had a danger to them and darkness, and there was a tenderness that went along with it, but there was always death in them, and there was always sort of something quite malevolent sort of mixing around with this magical story that would be happening as well.
And that, you're absolutely right, and that kind of tone permeated, not just it permeated from him into his production company, but then into films around him, like you know, things like Jim Henson's directorial debut, The Dark Crystal. There's you look around that era and there's this, they're dark fables, they're dark fairy tales, they're dark adventure stories.
They're dealing with death a lot. There's death in all these movies.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing that I got told when I was working on a kids project. You've got to stay away from death. And when I think back to the 80s as you're saying all this, it's like death is all over those films.
I don't get someone saying you got to stay away from death. But you know, the gas thing about it was, as I was saying about Spielberg being a businessman, is that he rings a guy, our famous character you've already brought up from a previous episode, the head of the MPAA, Jack Valenti.
In 1984, a series of films made it clear that a change needed to be made.
It was sort of a perfect storm of movies that I either produced or directed. It all sort of came together and created this parental objection to Gremlins being PG and to Temple of Doom being PG. And I agree with that. But I also felt it would have been unfair to have labeled either of those films R. I called Jack Valenti. I said, let's get a rating somewhere in between PG and R. Jack was proactive about it, completely agreed, and before I knew it, there was a PG-13 rating instituted.
The president of the Motion Picture Association, Jack Valenti, reluctantly bowed to public pressure.
I was opposed to any change in the rating system. I think it's a fragile system, and the insertion of more categories is not needed. I thought the PG itself was a sufficient warning, but so many of my peers in the business have taken an opposite view that I decided to lead this movement rather than to follow it.
What was the first film to have that rating?
The first film released to have it on its a PG-13 rating was Red Dawn.
Oh.
The rating was created for Spielberg. The PG-13 rating was created, but it's suggested by Spielberg and created for Spielberg to basically accommodate his pedigree of
productions,
cinema. And so, it was born from him. It just goes to show the power that man had in Hollywood.
The rating system is there to keep parents informed of how to guide their kids. The topic of conversation, at least around our dinner table, is the rating system.
So, Kevin, my pick, you set me up with your pick being Watership Down about rabbits. My pick for most inappropriate scene in a kids movie is also features and stars a rabbit. It's the film Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which was released in 1988.
This is the tale of an up-and-coming movie star named Roger Rabbit and a down-and-out private detective named Eddie Valiant.
Ooga booga!
Directed by Robert Zemeckis, adapted from the novel by Gary K. Wolfe, and adapted by the screenwriting team, Jeffrey Price and Peter S. Seaman.
And Will, just to say, you mentioned that the first unaccompanied film you saw was Pinocchio. This was my first unaccompanied film, Into the Big Bad City, the Capitol Cinema, with my mate from school, Tomas. And we watched Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and it was fucking amazing.
Oh, wow. what a film to see in your first on your first outing on your own. Like, and this is the funny thing about Who Framed Roger. I assume everyone knows the plot of this. The plot, like, is, you know, if you haven't seen
Who it's Framed about Roger Who Rabbit, Framed Roger Rabbit.
It's about Who Framed. It's it stars Eddie Valiant, who is a toon-hating detective played by the brilliant Bob Hoskins.
Rest in peace.
And he's Roger Rabbit, who's a cartoon star, and he's the Roger Rabbit's only hope to prove his innocence when Roger Rabbit is accused of murder. And yeah, it's a full-on noir movie, right? Using cartoon characters as
gangsters,
a lower class of citizen. Everything. They're the entertainers. They're the characters that are exploited. There's so much going on in this film that's, like, I rewatched it last night, and you can't but admire the wonder of it. The filmmaking of it is absolutely astounding.
It holds up so well as well. It looks gorgeous.
Yeah, it's shot beautifully. Even what's almost more impressive is if you get to look at the making of, if you type into Google making of Roger Rabbit, and there's a documentary there to show you the levels that they went to, where they mixed animated characters. Now, it's not the first time, certainly not the first time, 2D hand-drawn characters have been incorporated with live-action footage. But this is the first time it felt real. And the reason it felt real was the efforts to which the Dick Williams, the animation director, went to. They unlocked the camera. They moved the camera like they would in a live action movie. Like, they dollied and they panned and they moved around characters. And the challenge for the animators was to make the animated characters feel alive in that scene. And, oh my, everything was hand-drawn. Every single frame was hand-drawn of the character's movements. And it's unbelievable.
You know what I love about the animation in that is it sort of feels like it's a cross between the Disney animation and the Warner's animation. You sort of have this sort of... they've got this sort of luster of the Disney animation, but they have this sort of zaniness of the Warner's animation.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And a thing I want to talk about, kind of like, I suppose, give a little bit of, because I think it's thematic, I suppose it ties into the things we've spoken about beforehand. When Gary K. Wolfe wrote Who Censored Roger Rabbit, he had a 4-book deal with his publisher, right? And all his first three books were hits. Like, they just, no notes, went on the shelf, and he was flying. And then he had this idea for Who Censored Roger Rabbit. And in that, his animated characters, they weren't cartoon characters. They were comic book characters. So they were like flat 2D characters that appeared in the world. And when they spoke, they had speech bubbles over their head.
Really?
Now, I haven't read the book, but apparently the book is great, okay? It's supposed to be a fantastic book. And there's been two sequel books. The second book isn't as great because it's a direct sequel to the film. So it kind of negates some of the plot. But apparently the third book is continues from the first book, we'll say, the kind of the line of the first book, and apparently that's great as well. So I'm really interested in reading the original book. But guess what? So when Gary K. Wolfe went to his publisher, he's already had three hit books now. So he went to his publisher with this cool idea, Who Censored Roger Rabbit, and he had a cool manuscript, very good, and he sent it to him, and they just went, no, we're not releasing it, we can't publish it.
Because of his brand name as a sort of established writer at that stage, or what was it?
No. They said you can keep the money, you can keep the fee. We think it's an amazing book, it's a great read, but the marketing people say they don't know how to sell us.
Oh,
and yeah, so he kept it. He basically got to walk away with the manuscript and just went, Jesus, what the hell do I do with this? He sent it to other publishers and he was rejected. Guess how many times he was rejected?
I couldn't guess, to be honest, because I imagine it would be as many times as possible.
I'll tell you, 115 times.
Holy shit. Wow. That is tenacity on his part.
Yeah. Yeah, 100. And he said there would be days he would go to the post box and he would just basically collect several rejection letters a day at a time.
Do you know what that always feels like? It's a test to whenever something great and new comes along, it gets rejected out of hand because people have nothing to compare it to. So, that's just another example of how you have to stick to your guns because good stuff is never really embraced immediately. It usually takes some time when it's good and new.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And it was eventually someone... No, he told the story, and I found an interview with him where he told the story of the guy, the publisher, who took a punt with him. But again, this publisher just said, I don't know how this is... I think basically they released maybe a couple of thousand copies of it. And by pure chance, it was just pure serendipity. It didn't catch fire or anything like that. But by pure chance, it basically landed on the desk of someone at Disney, right?
Okay.
And,
yeah, yeah.
And they loved it. They thought, this is a great read. And they got the book to Roy Disney. Now, Roy Disney went, this is fantastic. And Roy Disney got in touch, basically optioned the book. But... You have to, this is 1980 or 1981, and you have to put in context, like, where Disney were at in 1980 or 1981.
Oh, it was their fallow period.
They had put a lot of money into that live-action sci-fi film, The Black Hole. They had no money. They couldn't get anything going. Even their animation stuff was, they were just recycling animation. They were, even though some of those films are still really enjoyable, but they were cutting corners and things were looking, they were kind of being kept afloat by the theme parks. That's
it wasn't
really
until
Little
Mermaid, was it, that they sort of had that resurgence?
No, not correct. Wait for it. You're not right. what happened was, Roy Disney gets this in his hands. He gets this book and he went, this could be something that could give us something unique and if we could pull it off, could be amazing. Look, we're an animation studio after all. We could do something with this. So he started approaching directors, and one of the directors he approached was Terry Gilliam. And Terry Gilliam was in line to do this back in about 1982.
I could see that. I could see Terry Gilliam doing Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, he's both the live action and the animation experience and that zany kind of crazy, match for him. But what happened was Roy Disney just couldn't get the rights, and he saw it as... He wanted to kind of do it the Toontown aspect where he needed the Warner Brothers characters as well. And Warner Brothers were in a pretty good kind of like run of form. And they just laughed
at
him.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Of
there was that whole rights issue thing, wasn't there?
Yeah, they just laughed at him and just says, not a chance. And the budget of it was really small as well at that stage. They were trying to do it they just couldn't afford it, or Warner Brothers weren't going to play ball. So you kind of a couple of years passed, and Roy Disney gets basically kind of semi-retired, and Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberg come on board it at Disney and take the reins. And that's when they get Steven Spielberg involved. And Steven Spielberg sees the potential for this immediately. And he says, well, the guy I picked, the guy he kind of taps to direct it is his buddy Robert Zemeckis, who's after coming from the hit of Back to the Future. And he says, Zemeckis is the guy who could really do something amazing with this. And they said, well, this is great. We've got it. We've got maybe a team, but there's no way Warner Brothers are going to give us the rights to the characters.
But everyone will say yes to Steven Spielberg.
That's exactly what happened. Steven Spielberg was so powerful that he walked over to Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers gave them the rights for a song. A really reasonable price. It was unbelievable. The only thing that there was big kind of contractual wrangling over was the amount of screen time, the amount of dialogue. They literally had to have...
Oh, it needed to be half and half, I suppose.
Exact same. Yeah, so every...
Steve McQueen and Paul Newman and Towering Inferno, exact same number of lines.
Yeah.
Same billing.
It was exact same. Same billing. Same number of frames of animation. They were so pernickety about they wanted equal sharing for both studios. Now, but why am I kind of bringing this up as being having like not just one, but I feel several inappropriate things that are in a
kid's
movie?
I think I know what one of them is going to be.
Okay, which one you bring up? Which you what one do you think it's going to be?
Well, it's the most disturbing scene I've ever seen in the cinema, and that is when the little shoe is dropped into the dip. That was horrifying, and yes. It still stares at me. It's one of the saddest scenes I've ever seen.
Huh? What's that? Remember how we always thought there wasn't a way to kill a tomb? Well, Doom found the way. Turpentine, acetone, benzene. He calls it the dip.
I'll catch the rabbit, Mr. Valiant. Then I'll try him, convict him, and execute him.
It's an awful scene of it's torture. It's torture of a cuddly, sweet, cuddly character. And it's awful. And this is a kid's movie. It's really disturbing. Like, it's completely unnecessary. Like, I can see why they've done it as a film, but like, that character doesn't deserve that. Yeah, we know that Judge Doom
but
is an
listen,
awful,
it's,
awful
we're
villain.
We're still talking about it, 30 years later? So, you know, it was worth
the
it.
The impact was there. Yeah, the impact is there. It's absolutely horrific. That's definitely one of the scenes. One of the other scenes, and this is a scene I'm practically kind of like going, oh, I don't think my kids should watch this. And it's a brilliant scene. It's the scene where we meet Roger Rabbit's wife, the famously buxom Jessica Rabbit, and who's voiced by Kathleen Turner, but she doesn't do Jessica's singing voice. And it's at basically a cotton club where you go in, where humans go in, and they're served by cartoon characters, and Jessica Rabbit comes out.
You had plenty of money, 1922.
And sings a really, really sexy number. And all of the guys, it's creepy, but I totally understand where they're coming from because, oh my God, you know, she's drawn amazingly.
She's almost as sexy as the caramel bunny.
Almost. But like, I find this scene to be, right, one, you've got, it's objectifying her in a way that's like not appropriate for a kid's film. It's portraying women, it's portraying the female figure in an impossible way. It's overtly sexualized in a way that's just, I think, you know, show, like kids.
It's great. Like,
it's also fantastic. It's also amazing because of how it's sold. Like when she goes up to Marvin Acme, and that's her kind of client for the night, when she's like, you know, the performance where she kind of slides her hand under his jacket and pulls his little handkerchief out of his pocket and squeakily like rubs the top of his head, the animatronic work, the real life puppeteering and the animation and the performance, it's just, it all works seamlessly where you feel this is real. Your brain is tricked into feeling this is a really beautifully drawn, incredibly sexy, but weird cartoon character. And it works, but it's totally, totally inappropriate. It's all, like, I would be kind of mortified showing it to my kids, you know. Now, I think, you know, I would be totally fine with them seeing it when they're, you know, in their teenage years. But right now, no, I don't think I could. I don't think I could show it to them. The other scene, and the final scene, and my kind of scene that really is my pick for like my best and most disturbing scene of this film.
I have no idea what this could be.
Well, it came to light from last night, really, watching it last night. And to show kind of how effective this film is, I had the same reaction to watching it last night as I had when I watched it as a kid, where I had a mixture of emotions of, one, I admired the hell out of it. I laughed with it. I loved watching it, right? Mm. I loved watching the film. But I was terribly, terribly unnerved by the film.
Really?
And the scene, yeah, I was really unnerved. It left me with a sense of disillusion. I know it's a story of redemption. But the scene that was most disturbing and inappropriate for me was the kind of the final climax scene where Judge Doom has revealed to be the real bad guy, as if we, you know, as if we didn't know that he was the bad guy in this. And in actual fact, he reveals that he's not a human judge. He's a Toon in disguise.
Self-hating Toon.
Yes, self-hating Toon.
Remember me, Eddie? When I kill your brother, I talk just like that.
He's a murdering, torturous. He is the worst. It's kind of like the Wicked Witch in the West from The Wizard of Oz. There's that kind of vibe out of it, where it's this, there's a fundamental kind of like unnerving terror and dread that his character elicits in me that I kind of can't understand, but I really think it's too goddamn scary for a kid's film. It's really, really, really strange, and it's brilliantly effective. But ultimately, the whole film then kind of ends. The film ends after that. Basically, they defeat him, but like the film ends where, well, hey, we saved Toontown, because that's what was kind of at stake. And it kind of goes, oh, everything's fine. That's all, folks, right? And it tries to wrap up in this nice, neat bow of everything's grand now, isn't it, folks? And there I am as an 8-year-old kid watching it at home and in a video. But I feel like I watched it in a cinema. And I was the exact same last night watching it. And I went, no, everything's not okay. What an awful world these Toons live in. The world is awful. And it's as if innocence, the film kind of, I feel the film kind of destroys an innocence and a purity and joy of comic book characters, because it posits this alternative universe where these comic book characters are exploited and tortured and are servants. And I just go, I hope it's not real. I hope it's not real. So it just made me feel depressed.
I promise you, Will, cartoons are not real.
Yeah, I know. Oh, thank God. So yeah, that's my pick for most inappropriate scene in a kid's movie.
But wait, who did frame Roger Rabbit?
Who did?
And why
frame Roger
doesn't
Rabbit?
Roger Rabbit have a question mark?
Grammatically inappropriate.
Yep.
But Kevin,
yes,
we have the business
episode
to,
8 done.
That is episode 8 in the bag. I can't believe it. Well, and this is the time of the week where we spin the wheel. So here we go. I'm just going to spin the wheel and spin.
I wish I had a veto. You have a veto. Can you give it to me?
Okay, it's still spinning. Kevin,
I'll give it to you for 50 pence.
Give me 100 quid. 50 pence? Go on,
yeah.
That, would you? Okay, it's spun. Kevin, it's spun. It's spun. Right, I'm just looking.
Okay, what is
I'm
it?
I'm looking. Are you ready for this?
I'm not, but go
your
ahead.
Topic for next week is best practical FX scene. Best practical FX scene.
Well, that's going to be a very visual episode.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's good.
Okay, I might have to ask my mate Dan Martin to help me out with that. He's a visual effects wizard and a practical effects wizard, so he might have some thoughts on that. But okay, let me think on that. I'm thinking creature features, I'm thinking 80s, I'm thinking, well, you'll find out next week.
There's so many cool, I actually forgot to bring up all the cool practical stuff they did in Roger Rabbit to make the animation look real. It's amazing. Please look at the practice. They made little robots. They made little robots for when the animated characters like interacted with the real world. So like when he was smashing plates on his head, they would have a little robot that smashed plates on its head, and it was amazing. It's absolutely brilliant. So you could have used that, but I have a take and no, Kevin.
Okay, so do you want to do next week's episode as well?
No. I feel I've contributed enough to this week. My head is busting up. But I'll sell you a veto if you want it. You want a veto?
As I said, I got 50 pence off this kid once in the cinema, and that's what I'm ready to offer you. Okay, well, where can people find
you? Okay. They can find me on Twitter under WillemsFilm, WillemsFilm. Kevin, where can people find you?
They can find me on MySpace under, they can find me on Twitter as well, at Kevin Meehan. And we also have a show Twitter feed, which is at BestBitsPod. And yeah, that's the show, I guess. So next week, best practical effects scene.
All right, looking forward to it. Looking forward to it. Best practical effects scene. Okay, good luck.
See you.
Piss off!
The Best Bits podcast is produced by Will and Kevin.
All audio clips and music heard in this episode is the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders and no infringement is intended.
If you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, rate, review, all that good stuff.
If you have any notes, comments, scene suggestions, or just want to get in touch with us, email us at bestbitspodcast@gmail.com.
And here is a clip from the lad's latest Mini Bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon.
Mini Bits.
Another new episode.
Tuck a D, stupid clumsy.
Patreon podcast.
Of this Patreon podcast. Exclusive.
Exclusive.
The Best Bits podcast with Will and Ken. Bonus content for you, yeah. That's right, this is for you.
Kevin, how are you?
Hi, honey. How are you?
Oh, you know, I've got this. I've got my corns sorted out. I went to the chiropodist the other day, and she
your
said,
corn.
"My corns. Did you ever get corns?
No.
Did you know what a corn is?
Yeah, it's a bunion on your foot, isn't it?
Yeah, like in between your toes, stuff like that.
Do you not wear any shoes like around the house? You walk
around
barefoot?
No, it's the opposite.
GA shorts.
It's the opposite. I wear incredibly tight shoes. Like those Chinese women who get their feet bound, who had their feet bound, like, you know, before the turn of this last century. And so they had incredible corns and bunions. This is a great opener for a Mini Bits episode where we get people disgusted.
Squally, it's episode 73 of the Mini Bits. I'm Kevin, you're Will. This is our Patreon podcast. Thank you to all our lovely patrons. Yeah. A few of you have jumped in recently. I don't know what we said. We try to goad people into joining up every single episode, and then every so often it's like a lot of people join because of one specific episode, and I'm like, how did we say on that episode that's different to the other 270 episodes?
Maybe it didn't sound as desperate. Maybe we said don't join. Maybe reverse psychology. That's how we should do it. Reverse psychology. Don't join up to our patron. Don't.
Cancel. Everybody cancel.
You don't deserve to be in this group. We don't want you. We don't like the look of you.
We don't need anybody.
It's just us. It's absolutely just us. Hey, should we tell people? We did, I don't know, maybe we shouldn't say it on mic, especially so early. We did an interview with the Irish Examiner last Friday.
We did?
Yeah.
And
How do you think I did?
I think you did all right. Like, you didn't interrupt me once, so I was delighted with how I came across. But, you know, there's no sort of time limit on this. We don't know when it's going to get posted. One of our friends was saying, Kathy at the cinema was saying that their interview with, did they do the Examiner as well? It was six months before it posted.
And the Guardian, I'm pretty sure. They were profiled in the Guardian as well.
Yeah, but we don't do any really promotion. Like, we don't do anything.
Well, this is our first time getting any sort of like proper coverage, which is going to be mad. So listen to all you listeners who have found us before we explode. You're an OG. You're an OG listener before Kevin starts getting gold chains from all his Patreon dash.
I think I'm more of a silver than a gold. I think my undertones suit more silver. But
I just want to die.
Goes with my Prince Albert.
Your hat?
Yeah.
I want one of those diamond studs in my tooth. That's all I want. So I can go bing whenever I'm on a call.
Oh, yeah.
Bing.
I usually just, you know, wink and that glints.
Yeah.
Like a starlight twinkle.
Speaking of which, I interrupted you. What did you want to speak of? Which?
Start the timer.
Oh! I forgot.
You may as well.
Start the timer.
All these lucky losers are listening in and they're wondering, what are we going to be talking about? Well, we have to start talking about them after.
Yeah.
we say goodbye. But look, I wanted to talk to you about, well, you've seen a few things. You've seen the new Godzilla film.
Yes.
I've seen the first Omen. I saw Scoop as well.
We're looking Netflix forward to watching this. We already see, okay.
Okay, I'll save my thoughts. And what else did I see? I made notes, but sure, it doesn't really matter.
I think I saw that.
And I was going to go through all the summer releases and see what takes your fancy.
Okay. I'm looking forward because I don't actually know what's on the horizon. So
the Joker 2 trailer came out today.
I saw it. Yes, I watched that.
Mm-hmm. It reminded me of Chicago.
Yeah, it's kind of like you see it's all very much in the mind's eye. They're calling it a jukebox musical. Am I right in saying that?
I think you're right in saying that.
So, look, hey, listen. What it did remind me of was that I want to rewatch The Joker because I saw it in the cinema and I thought it was fine. It was kind of a bold new direction.
I'm just going to go back and watch the episodes from the Batman 66 show. The Joker episodes.
Oh yeah, that's going
to
be
just to fill me in, like on the lore, you know, get up to speed,
get you right up to speed, and you'll be there going, where are all the guys in the purple suits with the masks? When are they going to show up? And like,
it's a bit of a weird time though, where we have the Penguin TV show with Colin Farrell coming out, which is a totally different canon version of the Penguin. Then you have this offshoot of Joker, which isn't. Its own universe entirely.
Mm.
And then you have the old Batman films that you can watch.
Right.
And, I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's just, I don't know. I'm kind
There's
of
so many
IP.
But like,
it's just everywhere.
What's happened is the comic book world has very much entered the film world. It's where you could have different runs, totally different runs of a character by
it's
different
insane.
Authors. And there would be totally different riffs on it and stuff. Oh, this is
insane.
The thing. Kevin, so I'm only catching up on this. You mentioned it to me on a podcast. Was it on one of those?
It was the last mini bits.
You said everyone's describing stuff as insane recently.
And have you started noticing it though?
Only with people trying to rise you. That's the only place where I've noticed people on Discord are trying to rise you.
Oh my god! Oh my god! I could start posting now, like, tweets, comments, TikToks. Articles, anything. Insane is everywhere. This is insane. That's insane. It's insane. There was a festival just going on about this insane lineup. I was like, oh, it's a mentally ill lineup. Okay. it's everywhere. And the other thing that's also bothering me lately?
Wow.
And this has been bothering me for years and years and years. It used to be that everyone used to misspell definitely. They'd go defiantly.
Okay.
Oh, it's defiantly whatever. It would just, they're morons. But no. I just keep noticing everyone keeps spelling a lot as one word, A-L-O-T, lot. Where have they gotten into their heads that a lot is one word? It's the same way that people will write every time as one word.
What's the one that you've pulled me up on a few times and I can't get it right? Compliment.
Compliment.
I can't, but I can't get it right. It's like the
I. Because I told you the other day.
Yeah, and I went searching for it and I couldn't find it because I had to actually use it.
If there's an I in compliment, it's I'm paying you a compliment.
That's a good way to remember it. Okay, good. And then compliment.
I wrote that to you.
But you did, and I went to try and find it because I found myself writing the word compliments. And I went, shit, Kevin.
But you gave me a thumbs up, which meant in my world that, yeah, I read that. Thanks.
But I did, right? I'm talking about a couple of days later when I was faced with the exact same hurdle of writing the word compliment. I went, okay, what did Kevin say again about compliment? There's an I and the E. What did he say? So I went searching for it and I found it, I think. And I went, oh, the I is paying me a compliment or I'm giving you
it's
a compliment.
It's insane how little you can retain information. It's insane.
Come here, let's start talking about what we watched. Come on.
Did you start the timer?
Yeah, it's gone. It's ticking. It's ticking down. The world's going to explode.
You know, I have to put in the sound effect. I have to line up all my sound effects.
When you said start the timer,
I have a whole soundboard here.
Okay.
Jesus Christ, where's my fucking
what?
Where's my ding dang ding?
Here we go. The timer has started. There we go.
There we go. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Right.